Welcome to the You Love and You Learn podcast, the place to learn about all things love, relationships, relationship anxiety, and to deconstruct the one-size-fits-all narrative of what it means to be in a happy relationship. I'm your host, Sarah Yudkin, a relationship anxiety coach who's on a mission to discuss the nuances of love and relationships that I wish someone would have shared with me years ago. My goal with each episode is for you to leave with an expanded definition of love and relationships and with practices to carry with you in your life and relationships on a day-to-day basis. I'm so grateful to have you here. Welcome back to another episode of the podcast. I'm really excited to bring this interview to you today with Rebecca Orr, who is a certified relationship anxiety coach that helps people who feel anxious and insecure in their relationships finally feel secure and confident. As well as decades of experience with her own anxious brain, she's helped hundreds of men and women tackle the limiting beliefs, stopping them from fully enjoying their relationships. You can find her on Instagram or her own podcast called Mastering Your Relationship Mind Drama. And I loved this conversation because there were so many tangible, bite-sized things that Rebecca shared, not only to help when you feel like your mind has a lot of drama, but when there are resulting emotions or your body feels like it's overwhelmed. And a lot of what we talked about just felt really easy to practice on the spot, even though, of course, it takes a practice to navigate some of these tools and new information. It felt really tangible. And I really enjoyed this conversation. I think you're going to love learning from Rebecca. So let's get into it. Hey, Rebecca, thanks for joining me.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, I'm excited to chat with you because from what I know about your story, obviously both of us have experienced our own form of relationship anxiety, but I feel like our stories are unique, or like the type of anxiety that we experienced showed up at least on the symptoms or in the surface in different ways. So can you share a little bit more about your journey with this? When did you start noticing you had relationship anxiety? When did you hit maybe like a breaking point?
Dive straight in. Yeah. So I have been a very anxious person ever since I can remember, really. I know in my teens, I was definitely very anxious about my relationships. And I know a lot of people get anxious either in their romantic relationships and then they're fine in their friendships, or maybe they get a bit of friendship anxiety, but they're fine with their romantic partner. I got the double whammy. I was just very, very anxious with all of my friendships and my romantic partners. So how it kind of showed up for me was just constantly overthinking every interaction, constantly ruminating about the state of my relationship. So did they like me? Was so-and-so mad at me? Did they still want to be my friend? Did this person I was dating, are they still attracted to me? Are we having sex enough? What if they cheat on me with someone else? And I was just, my brain was just constantly on red alert for signs of rejection and being abandoned and all those things. And I think it was this way all throughout my teens and then my 20s. And I spent so much time kind of getting into self-help and reading all the self-help books and listening to different podcasts. And yeah, eventually I actually came across an amazing coach called Carol Owenthal. So a little shout out to her. It's one of my favorite teachers. And I heard her talking about the brain and thoughts and feelings in such a way that I just never heard it talked about before. And something finally clicked for me. So I started looking into her work. I started joined her program. I did some of her work and I just completely changed so many of these thought patterns that were having me so anxious all of the time. And then, yeah, I ended up going and training at the exact school that she trained at, because that's how much I just fell in love with the tools and the concepts. And yeah, I never looked back. But yeah, to kind of go back to your first question of how did it kind of show up for me and where did it all start? Yeah, I think it was just this constant comparing myself to other people and believing that I had beliefs like I'm not as likable as other people. I'm a loser. I'm not good enough. Other people are more attractive than me. Other people are better than me. And so I was just constantly feeling so afraid in all of my relationships. And I was just miserable. It was just a miserable way to live.
Yeah, I unfortunately can resonate with a lot of those things. And for my type of relationship anxiety, I was less worried in my relationships of like, is this person going to cheat or leave? But those thoughts have popped up. Like, I definitely have jealousy sometimes. I can get those thoughts, but it showed up more as, oh, well, do I even love this person? Or what if I leave the relationship? But when I dig deeper, like, I can very clearly see that a lot of my own insecurities or fears what if I'm not good enough are showing up under that. So I can resonate. And a lot of my clients I know can resonate with, oh, she's prettier than me, or their relationship's better than mine. And just like you said, it's this constant comparing of who's better, who's worse. Am I good enough compared to this person? So was it like a specific breaking point where you just looked in the mirror and you were like, I'm done with my own shit? Was there something in a specific relationship that happened that made you realize, oh, I think that these are some of my patterns? Like, you shared how you started working through it, but was there kind of this point where you realized, I need to do something about it?
Yeah, I'd say with my ex-partner who I was with before the person I'm with now, that was probably the worst that I'd ever been anxious wise. I often think back and kind of laugh about some of the things that I used to say to her or the things I used to get anxious over, but it wasn't funny at the time. It was really, really hard. And she maybe was a bit on the avoidant side as well, which of course doesn't help any equation when you've got an anxious person involved. But yeah, I was just the most anxious I'd ever been. I remember we were doing long distance and she lived in London, I lived in Manchester, and I'd literally cry on the train every time I came back from seeing her because I would just be feeling so anxious. I didn't want to be away from her because when I was away from her, I'd have all these thoughts about, is she going to text me back soon? Am I going to be okay? Does she still want me? What if she has decided that she's bored of me and she breaks up with me? I was replaying the weekend. Did we have enough connection? Did we have enough time together? Did she like me enough? And it was just awful. And I think that was the lowest I'd ever been. So I'd say that was probably the breaking point when I realized, okay, something's got to happen now. I've got to do something about this because it's just something I would have taken into every single relationship because it was all about my brain, ultimately.
Yeah, for sure. And you use this phrase a lot. I know that it's part of, I think, your group coaching program title, but you also share about it in your content. You say the phrase mind drama. And I feel like I totally understand what that means. And a lot of people listening probably do. But like, aside from just, okay, your mind's going a lot, what do you mean by mind drama? What's actually happening? And what are we doing in those moments when there's mind drama going on?
Yeah. So the way I describe mind drama is, it's kind of the nonsense in our brains. So our brain is obviously constantly having loads and loads of thoughts. We have about 60,000 thoughts a day. And most of the time, we're not having kind of intentional, rational, calm thoughts. We're having just gibberish, primitive brain nonsense. And that's kind of what mind drama is. It's the unnecessary, anxiety-creating, unhelpful thinking that the brain will create just on default by accident without you intentionally choosing it. So yeah, that's the phrase I use to describe it. But some people will call it their chimp brain or their monkey mind or their lizard brain. It's anything to describe that primitive part of your brain that isn't always the most rational and that is probably creating a lot of suffering for you. That's how I would describe it.
Yeah. Even though I do this and I help other people navigate their mind, it can be so hard to realize that those primitive thoughts are not necessarily the truth, right? When you're crying on the train back and you're like, oh my gosh, what if she doesn't love me enough? Or is she going to text me enough? It's like, that's a thought popping up, but I think automatically, especially if we don't have practice with it, we just tend to hook into those thoughts as like, oh, well, that's true. So like, I have to now go do something about it. Like, I have to take action on this and I have to figure it out. And I feel like that's where I was stuck for so long. And sometimes I still get stuck there, but I'm much more able to see that pattern. But what are the first steps that you do? Or how do you like start to gain awareness of when something is mind drama versus something that you actually need to like figure out or do something about?
Yeah. So the way I like to do this is what I help my clients with as well, is first step is always kind of separating out the facts of a situation from your thoughts about it. So your thoughts are anything that's an opinion, anything that's an interpretation. So if you're thinking of something as either good or bad or right or wrong, that's a thought, it's an opinion. Doesn't mean that we need to get rid of it. Doesn't mean that we want to not choose it, but we just want to separate out that thought, that optional way of thinking, from the facts that have happened. So it could be partner hasn't texted back for 5 hours or whatever. Okay, what's my thought about that? What am I making that mean? Often when we see that and we can see the facts, we can see how big of a jump our thought is. You know, we're like, whoa, like, why am I making the fact that they didn't say I love you and they just said love you mean that they've lost interest, which is such a common one I hear. Or, oh, okay, we didn't have sex this weekend. Why am I making that mean that the relationship is doomed? We can kind of see that. That seems like a bit of a jump brain. That seems like a, you know, the Olympic long jump of assumptions to be making. Other times it might not seem that much of a jump, and we might need to stay and really question, okay, why am I making it mean this? But I think one of the biggest things I always help my clients with is it's not even so much about trying to decide whether a thought is true or if there's evidence to prove a thought true. It's about looking at whether your way of thinking about something is helpful, because we can't change the facts. We can't change the facts of what people do, what people say, but we can start to decide on purpose, how do I intentionally want to show up to handle that? What do I want to think about it? What thought would serve me in moving forward from this place? And so, yeah, I think that's the first step, is just to separate out those things so that you can get some kind of clear premise of like, okay, what is actually going on here, and what is just the story, the anxious story that my brain is offering me.
Yeah, I found that to be so helpful too. And my business coach was saying something to our group the other day, and it just clicked with me. It made so much sense. She said, make up a story that's in your favor because you're often making up a story anyway. So it's
Yeah.
like,
Our
okay,
brains never like to do
exactly. It's like
that.
they didn't text me back because they are going to break up with me, or okay, they didn't text me back because they're busy. I know that's not the intuitive thing, but when you slow down, like you said, to acknowledge, okay, the fact of the matter is I didn't get a text back. The story I'm adding is this. It takes so
Yeah.
much practice to acknowledge that is just a story, but I can make up a story that's in my favor. Yeah, I don't know if that's true, but I don't know if the other thing's true either. It's hard, but if we don't shift into like creating a helpful story, then we're always going to default to that unhelpful one because
Yeah,
our brain's trying to
yeah,
protect us.
yeah. And that's it. And I feel like I may be jumping ahead a little bit here, but that is really the crux of it, especially with people with these anxious thoughts. We're always just trying to protect ourselves. And I think that was it. When I was on the train and I was crying and I was had all these what if thoughts in my brain, what I was really afraid of was a feeling. So, okay, if it's true that she thought the weekend was terrible and she's planning on breaking up with me, then I'd have to go through a breakup and I'd have to have all these terrible thoughts and feelings. That's always what we're afraid of. We're afraid of a thought and feeling that we might have to experience if that scary thing happens. And for so many of my clients, when we actually look at what that thought and feeling is, it's not the, I call it like clean pain. So I teach that there's clean pain and dirty pain. So clean pain is the negative emotion you want to feel. If your partner breaks up with you, you don't want to feel happy. You want to feel sad. You want to mourn. You want to grieve. You want to be disappointed. Don't really want to coach yourself out of that. We're trying to feel that and let that be the human experience, versus what I call dirty pain, which is the pain that is created by unintentional thoughts that are just creating so much unnecessary suffering. So the fact that they broke up with me means that I'm not good enough. I wasn't lovable. It means I'm never going to meet somebody else. I'm never going to find someone else that I connect with like this. So for a lot of my clients, I'd say 99% of them, when they're so afraid of something happening in the future, what they're afraid of is the dirty pain. They're afraid of this meaning that they've attached to it. So, okay, if this person has gone off me, or if they don't want a second date, or if they do cheat on me, that's going to mean that I wasn't lovable. It's going to prove my story true, that I wasn't attractive enough. I'm not as good as other people, that I never can make a relationship last, or whatever the story is. And so, yeah, I think just recognizing that in these moments, okay, my brain is really trying to protect me right now, but it's trying to protect me like from itself. My brain is trying to protect me from something mean it might say to me in the future. It's kind of really crazy when you think about it like that. But I think that really helped me too, because I could kind of remind myself, like, okay, while I can't control that that might happen, I can control what I would want to make it mean. And that's where the work kind of begins to change that belief of what it would mean.
Yeah, no, for sure. Thank you for sharing those examples. And just also to bring it to my story too, for anyone listening that might resonate with this, when I would worry, well, what if I want to leave my relationship, or if this doesn't
Yeah.
work out because it wasn't the one, or whatever intrusive thoughts I used to have, then I would always revert to, well, then I would have made a huge mistake and missed the potential best relationship ever. And then that would mean I'm not capable of having a relationship. So it still kind of
Yeah.
tracks down to this core fear or belief of I'm not good enough, or I won't have a good enough life or relationship. And
I'll have to feel regret. Yeah.
exact the mind drama that you're saying, it's almost like that dirty pain of, oh, well, then something horrible happened and it was my fault versus just, no, something sad would happen and you would figure out how to move through it. So not as always easy to remember, but this is what we're going to get into more today. So another thing I think that is common, obviously going underneath the surface of some of this, is you mentioned earlier, like, okay, my fear of abandonment was coming up, or the fear of rejection, or that's really the core underneath some of these things, is not only, well, what would happen in the future, but if that happened, could I handle it? So how does someone gain more awareness of the core fears that are driving them? Because you just kind of mentioned a lot of what we're doing is trying to protect ourselves from these bad things happening. But how can we identify more clearly, like, okay, these are the fears that are driving me, so that I don't have to let them be in the driver's seat and I can be in a relationship with the fear without letting the fear dictate everything?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think for me, there's kind of a few questions you can use when you're doing your own work on this. And some of those could be, say your brain is saying, well, what if they cheat on me? Or if you're having negative thoughts about your partner and you're questioning some of their behavior, whatever it might be, kind of coming back to the questions of, okay, so what? Why would that be a problem? Or what would I make that mean? And you can kind of follow that down. So it's say like with yours, if you're like, what if I'm making the wrong decision? What if we break up in the future? Okay, so what if you do? What would you make that mean? And you would have uncovered that thought. Well, then it would mean that I'd have to feel loads of regret, and that it would mean I can't trust myself and I'd never meet anyone else. Like, we'll start to, that the more you can kind of question, using these questions, kind of like peeling back the layer, like we can start to really follow your brain down the rabbit hole a little bit, so to speak, so that we can see what's actually down there. So yeah, asking questions like, okay, so what, brain? So what if that does happen? What would I make that mean? And then again, so what? Would it really mean that? We can just kind of peel back the layers and follow it down to see what's really there. And usually, like you said, what's there is some kind of belief about ourselves. 9 times out of 10, it comes down to something about us that we believe we weren't good enough, we failed, something wrong with us. So yeah, that's how I'd say about doing it. And I think for anyone that's listening that just knows that they feel a lot of anxiety, or maybe even they're not even aware of how they're feeling, they're just aware that they're not showing up in a way that they like, maybe they're just at like the action part of it, trying to follow that backwards a little bit. So if you know you're showing up in a way that you don't like, really consider, how am I feeling when I'm doing that? And when I'm feeling that way, what is it I'm thinking? Because if you can kind of step backwards to work out the root of it, which is of course always our thinking is always driving the way we act, that's when you're going to get some real insight.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm just super curious. This is kind of a random question that just came up as you were talking. Like, what are your thoughts on, like, should we be trying to get rid of our fears? I'm putting that in air quotes, or should we create a different relationship with fear? Because I feel like,
yeah, totally.
You know, a lot of times, even I'll say it sometimes, or the coaching or therapy world, it's kind of like, all right, helping you navigate through your fears or work through your fears. Yeah. But I feel like also you said earlier that primitive part of our brain, it's not
it's
like
always going to be afraid. Yeah,
exactly. It's not like we can just be fearless. You personally, how do you try to build a relationship with your fear so that it's still there, but you are in communication with it versus it taking over completely?
Yeah. Oh, I love that question. And yeah, I think you're totally right. It's both. As always, with any question like this, it's like, should I do this or this? It's usually, you should do both. So yeah, like we can totally work on changing our anxious and fearful thought patterns so that we have more default thought patterns that create security and confidence. And that's great. And that's a big part of the work that I do. But yeah, another big part of it is just accepting that for as long as you're a human on this planet, you're going to have a brain that says scary shit to you. And you're going to have to learn to change your relationship to your brain so that you don't take it so seriously. And I love a book called Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway by Suzanne Jeffers. You've probably read it. Anyone that hasn't, I definitely recommend it. It's an amazing book. But she talks about how fear is just this normal part of what it is to be human, and kind of embracing it as just a part of what it is to be human, and not letting it stop you from doing things. So I think, yeah, I think that's part of it, is embracing that these emotions are going to come up. Your brain is going to whisper things to you that feel really scary. And if you can just hold space for that and not beat yourself up and not tell yourself, oh my God, you're such an idiot that you're anxious about this. What's wrong with you? Why is your brain still doing this? If you can just kind of hold space for, yep, my human brain's being a human brain. It's trying to protect me. That's literally its job. Thank you, brain. I hear you. I see you. Then lovingly redirect it to where you want to go. Yeah, I think that's where the magic happens. It's a bit of both, I'd say.
Yeah. And I know some people really resonate with this type of thing and others don't, but I'm curious to hear how you navigate this on your own or with your clients is kind of playing out that worst case scenario. But I think sometimes that can be really intimidating of, okay, like, but the worst case scenario, that would really suck, or that would be really bad. Yeah. And we can kind of get stuck in thinking that we couldn't handle something like that, or, well, yeah, I really hope that doesn't happen. So how do we create a healthier relationship with the worst case scenario and then a healthy relationship with our own self-trust and knowing that we would be able to handle a negative situation?
Totally. Yeah. And I think, so where I'd start with that is kind of first getting clear of, is it clean pain I'm afraid of, or is it dirty pain? You know, is it just that I don't think I could handle the heartbreak of a breakup? Just staying with the breakup example, it could be something else, but is it that I just don't think I could handle the pain, the heartbreak, you know, the logistics of breaking up, how sad I'd feel? Is it that I'm afraid of? Or is it the attached meaning? Is it something about me? Because of course, like, if there is meaning you've attached to it, that it means you're not good enough, that it means you'll never find someone else, we've got to challenge those beliefs. For a lot of people, it can just be the clean pain. It's just, I just don't ever want to go through grief. I don't ever want to go through loss. I don't want to have to go through disappointment or heartbreak. I think really even looking at that, you said that yourself, like that belief of, I couldn't handle it. And I think challenging just that belief is important, because as much as we want to resist it, going through difficult things and going through painful emotions is part of being human. So the more we kind of resist it and tell ourselves, I don't want to go through that, the more frustration and resistance we create. And something really helped me, actually. I was coaching myself on something about a year ago. It was a scary situation that I thought was looming, and I really didn't want it to happen, and I was really anxious about it. And something that really helped me was actually something that I read in one of Byron Katie's books, Loving What Is. Again, another one I really recommend to everyone. But she talks about being willing. She sounds so strange. She's like, I am willing for my partner to cheat on me. Who is going to say that in their right mind? But I swear to you, when I said this to myself and really worked on this for this particular situation, okay, I'm just willing for it to happen. Not, I don't want it to, I hope it doesn't. But if it has to happen, if that is what the universe has in store for me, if that is going to be what it is, I'm willing to go through it. And it sounds strange, but even when I just say that to myself, I still use that phrase every now and again. It's like my shoulders just drop. I stop resisting. I'm like, okay, I'm willing to face it. Yeah, it's going to be hard. The pain will be hard. But I've handled negative emotion before. I can do it again. I've gone through grief. I've had disappointment. I've gone through terrible breakups. And kind of being willing to face that worst case scenario, it makes it so much less painful in the run up to it. Who knows if it's even going to happen? But that suffering you feel in advance is all from you resisting ever having to go through it. So whatever the reasons are that someone is resisting it, first get clear on those reasons. Is it the dirty pain? Is it that you've made it mean something terrible about you? Is it a belief about your ability? Is it just that your brain is like, nope, negative emotion is not something I ever want to deal with. I'll press eject on that. Whatever it is, just get really clear on that and then try and work with your brain to consider, okay, maybe I could handle it. Like, what is the evidence to suggest that maybe I could be okay? Have I maybe been through pain before? Have I been through disappointment before? Have I been through a breakup? Have I ever had to do something that I never thought for a million years I could do and then surprised myself? And kind of help your brain to collect evidence of how, okay, if this ever happens, maybe you could handle it.
Yeah, I love that phrase of I am willing. And two examples of that just came up for me of how that could be helpful. One thing for me that I had to be willing to do, which is still, it would be painful if Nate and I didn't work out, right? It's like, we're engaged, we're planning our wedding. If that didn't work out, of course I would be very sad. But at one point, as I was navigating through my relationship anxiety and more in the thick of it, I realized I was so scared of a potential divorce or like a potential breakup that I forget how I've described this before, but it's almost like I was pulling back from a divorce instead of moving toward this relationship. Yeah. I was so scared that it was like, I was kind of just protecting myself. And it's like, how is that going to create the relationship I desire? It's not. So I had to be willing to have divorce or breaking up as an outcome in order to be more open to also building love. So like, that was one example that came up. And then also just being willing to wake up and have anxiety that day, for example. Like, that's something I know that there's still sometimes where I'm just like, oh, I would have like to wake up today feeling more excited or more whatever. But if there's a morning where you wake up feeling anxious, or someone's listening and they're feeling that constantly, if every single time you wake up feeling anxious, you're like, oh, not again, this is
yeah,
going
I
to
don't
be
want
the
this
worst day
going.
ever. Exactly. It's like, I know that that's a common way to respond, and I've been there and I sometimes still do it. But that notion of I am willing to feel anxious today, or I'm willing to experience whatever comes up for me today, it just gives you so much more power. And then, like you said, ironically, it ends up creating more of the desired outcome because you're not just battling against what's coming up.
Yeah. And it's so crazy. And I say it's crazy. We all do it, me included. But it's just crazy how the brain is so afraid to experience a negative emotion tomorrow, or in a month's time, or in 10 years' time, whatever, that we feel so much negative emotion today.
Yep.
That we're so afraid that we'll feel anxious or sad or grief tomorrow that we feel anxious and grief and sadness today. It's like, it's crazy how our brain does that. And I think one of the best things that I ever learned when I did my training, and when I was kind of learning from one of my teachers, is called Brooke Castillo, an amazing coach. But she talks about emotions and how emotions are just vibrations in the body. Like grief is maybe a heaviness in your arms or your chest. Anxiety for me, for example, is a real tightness in my chest, and sometimes my throat closes. And sadness, maybe it's a hollow feeling in your stomach, or I don't know, we all experience them differently, but that's all emotions are. That's all negative emotions are. They're just feelings in your body. Yet we spend so much time being terrified to ever have to feel them. And I think a big part of this, I always work on my clients with this, is kind of changing their relationship to their negative emotion so that they can kind of trust themselves to handle it. It's okay. Yeah. When I feel a negative emotion, I let it rise, peak, and dissipate. I let the sensations be there, and then I move forward and I'm okay. And I think the more you can have that relationship with it, pain in the future is still not something you want. You're not gonna be like, yay, sign me up for a breakup, but you can kind of be more like, okay, I can handle it. I don't need to be afraid of negative emotion. I'm on board to go through it when I need to. So yeah, I think that's such a big part of this, like you said, is not resisting that negative feeling and finding a way to make peace with it.
Yeah. So good. Yeah, it's so important. There's a statistic that I love. I'm remembering her name right now. Jill Bolt Taylor, who's a neuroscientist. She studied that feelings typically last just about 90 seconds.
Yeah, I've heard that one too. Yeah.
When they're clean feelings and we aren't attaching the dirty mind drama to it.
Yeah.
So like if I'm sad and I let myself feel sad without, oh, I'm sad because of Nate, or I'm sad because of this thing that someone said on social media, and then I get sucked into what that person said and what it means, that sadness could in theory pass much more quickly.
Yeah.
But the mind drama, the story that we add on
Yeah.
top of it, that's actually what's causing it to feel either blocked or like we're feeling something for a longer period of time. And so that has really helped me just be aware as well. Like even if I'm sitting and meditating and I notice a sensation come up, it's like, all right, come back to the breath, or just focus on what I'm doing instead of the thoughts, because otherwise it feels like the sensation is then caught or trapped in my body somehow.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, and that's what I teach my clients as well. It sounds like the same kind of thing of processing emotion, and we have to come out of our brain to do that. We can't kind of logic ourselves away from the emotion. We have to be willing to sit and feel it in the body. So yeah, that makes sense.
Definitely. Well, little pivot, but still related to our mind drama and how we think about things in relationships. You know, one thing that especially can come up as someone who maybe has been navigating anxious attachment patterns is this notion of reassurance. So you talked about in past relationships being like, I need to hear from them all the time. What does it mean if I don't hear about them? And I think also in my world, there can be a reassurance of, okay, am I in the right relationship? There's a lot of ways that we can seek reassurance from people outside of ourselves to feel good internally. But I also think that reassurance kind of gets a bad rep. Now it's like, don't ever seek reassurance because then you're codependent, or, you know, you always have to be able to process everything on your own. So what's your journey with reassurance? What do you think about it? Is it good? Is it bad? Is it somewhere in the middle? Like, what should people be reflecting on when it comes to their tendency to seek reassurance?
Yeah. Again, I agree with you. It's neither bad or good. It's somewhere in the middle. It's not a problem to ever ask for reassurance. I think anyone in the world that says, especially someone that has a bit of an anxious tendency, that says they never ask for reassurance would be a liar. We all do. We all want to check in with our partners, maybe double check that things are okay sometimes. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with, especially just being open and vulnerable with your partner and letting them know what's going on in your brain. I think that's really important for connection and understanding each other. And I think that's a lovely thing. The only time I think that it's a problem is people with anxious brains that have these beliefs that their partner's going to leave them or cheat on them or that they're not good enough. The reassurance is going to feel lovely in the moment. It's going to be like a nice little dopamine hit. Because in that moment, their partner says something to them, they think, okay, phew, I'm safe, everything's fine. And then they feel that dopamine and everything's lovely. But their brain's going to go straight back to believing the anxious and insecure thoughts because those are the thoughts that they're practicing most of the time. Those are the things they believe. So although the reassurance is lovely, it's like taking paracetamol for a broken arm rather than actually the bone actually healing. It's treating the pain and it feels great, but it's not actually fixing the problem. And so I think if that's something that anyone listening can relate to, that they feel like the reassurance feels great in the moment, but then the next day, they're back to feeling insecure and they're back to feeling anxious. The old thought patterns are coming back up. Yeah, that's when it's like, okay, you need to really work on believing this for yourself, changing the thoughts, grappling with whatever this is for you. Because yeah, the reassurance is a nice holiday from that, but that's not going away until you really work on it. I think I did a poll about this actually on my Instagram, and I said, how long does it last for you after you've got reassurance before the anxious thoughts come back? And I think 90% of people were like, the next day it's back. So it's like, yeah. So it doesn't last long. It's often someone can say nice things to us, we feel reassured. And then literally an hour later, our brain's like, but what if? Or maybe they didn't mean it like that. Your brain's going to try and argue with it. So yeah, that's kind of my take on reassurance, that it's not bad. It's not a bad thing to do. And you should definitely be honest and vulnerable and open with your partner. But yeah, if you are constantly wanting reassurance, it's a sign that you have work to do for your own brain, for your own self and your own beliefs, and that you really have to do that for yourself.
And something that you just said kind of had like a light bulb moment for me where it's like there could almost be different types of reassurance. Like one of them is more of that dirty mind drama, or I forget what the phrase you use, dirty pain. It's like if we're coming from that dirty pain or the dirty lens of adding meaning and hooking into our thoughts as something wrong with us, the reassurance that we might seek could be coming from that I need them to fill me up type thing. And it's like you're always making it about something wrong with you. And so it's kind of you're just going to need more and more reassurance because it's coming out of that fear place. Whereas more of that clean pain is like, hey, I'm just feeling really lonely. Can we spend some quality time together and can we reconnect? The ways that those two would show up would be very different. And so it's one of them is more feeling the actual pain of loneliness, disappointment, wanting connection with your partner. But one of them is, oh, well, this must mean I'm bad or I'm unlovable or the
Yeah,
relationship's
totally.
not good enough. And so it could be very different the way that you approach that.
Yeah, please just say nice words so that I can believe you still love me and that I'm still good enough. That kind of thing is, yeah, the one we want to watch out for.
And it kind of ties into another thing I wanted to ask you about. You have this analogy I saw in one of your posts, or maybe multiple, of transforming your self-worth from being something that's constantly up and down. You gave the analogy of a stock market, which is sometimes it's
Yeah.
up, sometimes it's down. And I think that kind of ties into reassurance nicely when it's if your self-worth is only reliant on kind of external circumstances or other people, then that might be a slippery slope. So, yeah, talk to me a little bit more about your experience with that and how you go or how you guide other people to go from being so up and down with their own worthiness to being a little bit more steady.
Yeah, totally. And this was a metaphor that was actually used when I was being coached by one of the coaches I mentioned at the beginning, Cara Lowenthal. She was coaching me on some of my friendship anxiety. And she used this metaphor, and it stuck with me ever since. And she described it as my self-esteem being like the stock market. So if someone texts me back, I could be like, yay, I'm likable. And then if they didn't text me back or they canceled plans, oh, okay, now I'm a loser and I'm not good enough. Or like, say, a romantic partner, if they ask me on a second date, yay, I'm good enough. Or if they didn't like my picture on Instagram, oh, okay, I'm not good enough again. I must not be attractive enough. And it really is this thing of, like you said, basing what you get to think about you, what you think about yourself and your value on how other people act. And it's so common. Every single one of my clients, this is something that I have to coach all of them through because it's kind of the biggest thing underpinning all of this is we kind of believe that the way people treat us or the way people think about us or whether people want to date us or not date us or be our friends, we think that that's a reflection of our worth. And yeah, as long as we're believing that, our sense of self, our self-esteem, is just going to be going up and down based on the random actions of other people. I see this all the time as well with people that I'm coaching that are single and they're on the dating apps. They do this where if they match with one person, their self-esteem is suddenly in that person's hands. And if they're messaging them back, they can feel good about themselves. But the week before, it was someone totally different that they matched on a totally different app. And it's kind of crazy how we think about it. We're giving these random people, we're kind of crowning them in charge of being the ones that get to determine our worth and value, our self-esteem. So yeah, I think the biggest thing that we have to do and what I really had to work on was really separating out what my thoughts were about me and what I wanted to think about myself from the behaviors of others. Because what we tend to think is that if we're likable, they will like us. If I am funny, they will find me funny. If I am attractive, they will be attracted to me. And that's kind of the thought error that a lot of us have versus no, they're just a human with their own brain. They have their own thoughts and feelings. They may like you, they may not like you. That has nothing to do with how valuable or likable you are as a person. You just exist, and a million different people could have a million different thoughts about you. So yeah, for me, that was what it was really about, separating out those two things and learning to think about myself in a way that was independent from what anyone else thought about me. You know, what did I want to think about me? Did I want to think I was funny and kind and a good friend and fun to be around? Because we get to believe that even if one person that we match with on Tinder doesn't agree, or even if our best friend of 9 years or whatever decides that they no longer think that, we get to decide what we think about ourselves, and we can make that something separate from what they think.
Yeah, super powerful. I think that's so important too, to separate. I've had clients, or I've done this myself, where it's like, you basically are, oh, if I get the promotion, then that means I was worthy of the promotion, versus no, I just put in 2 years worth of effort and really did my best. So it's like, I can measure the outcome, or I can measure what I put into it, and the what you put into it, that's core to who you are. But it's so hard to separate those things sometimes. So is there anything specifically that you did? Did you literally write out, oh, I was measuring my worth based on this thing? Did you start literally taking note of it? Or did you start off by saying, okay, how do I want to think about myself? And then practicing finding evidence of that? Was it a tangible practice, or?
Yeah. So a lot of what I teach is about practicing new thoughts. So this isn't affirmations where you just come up with a super lovely thought about yourself and go and practice that, because for a thought to actually become, to create a neural pathway in your brain, you have to believe it. So what I teach is that we can come up with new ways of thinking, new thoughts, and practice them regularly. And the more you practice them, the more they're going to create neural pathways in your brain, and they're going to become your default way of thinking. But they do have to be believable. So I teach a tool called the Thought Ladder, which helps you find those kind of believable baby step thoughts. For example, maybe I wasn't ready to believe I'm a super fun, kind, amazing person. But maybe I could believe it's possible there are some likable things about me. Mm-hmm. And that felt a lot better than I'm unlikable, no one likes me, I'm a loser. So it's kind of finding what's the next step I can go to. Like, is it possible there are some likable things about me? Okay, I can start practicing that thought. And yeah, like you said, finding evidence of it. Your brain's going to go and try and find all the evidence to prove the opposite belief true, the belief that makes you feel terrible. And I was totally doing that. So with that belief, for example, that I was unlikable, I could give you so much evidence to prove that true. I'd be like, well, this friend didn't want to hang out with me anymore, and this person broke up with me when I was this age, and this person didn't want to go on a second date with me. And I could give you all that evidence. But what my brain was totally ignoring was all the evidence of, oh, everywhere I've gone, I've made new friends. And there's this many people have wanted to date me and be in relationships with me. And I've had these relationships that have lasted this amount of time. And it kind of ignores all that evidence that, okay, there were some people that seem to like you and want to hang out with you. It just focuses on, oh, here's all the evidence that would suggest the opposite. So yeah, definitely coming up with what you want to think about yourself, make it something believable that you can actually get on board with. And then yeah, looking for evidence of that. You could write that down. You know, you can, as well as practicing the new thought, you could write it down in a journal and write down the evidence of that. So what's all the evidence that people do actually like hanging out with me? Okay, my best friend wants to see me all the time. My friends from uni still text and arrange gatherings, like whatever it is. Okay, what's all the evidence that this belief is true? And yeah, the more you do it, you're going to create so much more evidence for it, and it's going to start to become the default. So yeah, that was how I did it, and it's what really worked for me.
Yeah, super helpful. Yeah, I'm in a similar camp of not starting off with something that feels super unattainable. Looking in the mirror, it's like, I love myself. It's like,
yeah, okay. I'm a beautiful goddess. No.
Yeah, like it doesn't feel safe to my nervous system to tell myself that because I don't feel like I
am. You don't believe it.
Yeah, you don't believe it. So it's like, okay, like I'm always doing my best. Or like you said, I have some qualities that I think can be good or whatever it is. It's starting small. I love that analogy of the thought ladder and then building up from there when you feel more comfortable.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And it's amazing because it sounds very simplistic, but this is why I love these tools, because I just, for me, I have quite a cognitive thinking. I'm very up in my head a lot. So this work might not be what resonates with everyone. Some people much prefer tapping or doing other things like that. But for me, I'm always up in my head. So I found the best way to deal with my brain was to kind of use these very cognitive, practical tools. They're not going to be for everyone, but they're definitely what has really worked for me.
Yeah, for sure. And I know that you mentioned a little bit earlier about helping clients also tap into like their emotion and their body. So I feel like it's both. And so what are some of the, do you feel like it's weekly, daily? Do you have certain practices that you incorporate, breath work, meditation, anything like that? It's just interesting for me to hear what other people's routines. I'm on and off with it myself. So I just like to learn whatever other people are doing.
Yeah. For me, what I do is this thing called processing emotion, or that I don't know if there's another word for it, but that's what I describe it as, which is really just whenever I feel an emotion, it's coming out of my brain for a minute and putting all my attention onto where I can feel it in the body and noticing what it feels like. And I describe it to myself. So I notice, is it like tight and heavy? Is it kind of pulsating? Could it have a color? Do I imagine it to be like a red blob or like a black square? I don't know. Is it hot? Is it cold? And I just spend time with that sensation. And yeah, with every breath, it's like, I imagine I'm making room for it. I'm letting that sensation be there. And whenever I do this, it's such a beautiful thing, because even if the sensation doesn't completely dissipate and evaporate, that's fine. It's like my entire experience of it changes. It's like my body just kind of relaxes around it, and it just settles and kind of moves through a little bit. So that's the main one that I really use whenever, even if I'm just feeling a bit overwhelmed or a bit stressed, it's like, pause, take a breath, acknowledge what I'm feeling. I'm feeling overwhelmed. And just take a minute with my body and just feel it. So yeah, and that's something that people can practice doing anywhere. I know some people struggle because they're like, well, I can't just stop and meditate when I'm in the middle of a busy supermarket. It's like, no, you can't, but you can just take a minute to just acknowledge to yourself, like, okay, this is really stressful and overwhelming. Notice where you feel that sensation. And just mentally, it's that mental willingness again that we've talked about a lot on this podcast, but that willingness to have it there, like, okay, I'm willing for this sensation to hang out with me, can come with me around the supermarket, can come with me to get the bread. I'm just going to relax around it. It's totally okay that it's here. Yeah, that's been such a life-changing practice for me. And I always teach it to my clients, and it's one of the biggest things that they then put into practice themselves from the coaching, because it is such a game changer.
Yeah, definitely. And I love the way you said it, where you're with each breath, you're like making more space for the sensation. Yeah. Cause I think sometimes when you think about breathing, first of all, I know, you know, that like sitting here and being like, just breathe, it's not always as simple as that. But at the same time, it can be. If you're at the supermarket, if you're on a date with your partner, can you literally just breathe and focus on making space for the sensation, that willingness that you talked about? Are you willing to slow down and do that? Because sometimes I think we think that it's such a big deal to stop and pause and breathe. But for me, I know that if I don't stop sometimes and physically write something or do a breath exercise or whatever it is, then the next few hours are spent up in my head just swirling. And so even though maybe, yes, it's not natural to stop and do these things, then at first you're going to feel like, why am I doing this? Why do I have to do all this
pointless stuff?
It's
not going
to
work.
Or like, why do I have to put all this effort into just living my life? But it's because our brain is just constantly, again, trying to keep us safe and protected and in our little comfort zone. And so anything that pushes us outside of our comfort zone, like being in a relationship where you don't have a guaranteed outcome, there's going to be thoughts that pop up. And so I think it's so great that it's such a simple tool, even though I've heard it before and maybe even other people have heard that before, but are we actually using the tool? That's the thing that matters.
Yeah. Yeah. And I always say that I remember one time I was in York for the day with my mom and we were wandering around and I suddenly felt so anxious. And of course, first of all, what I did was resist the hell out of it. I was thinking, oh my God, it's going to ruin my day. Why won't this go away? And then I remembered what I teach and I was like, okay, no, I'm not going to resist it. And I literally said to myself, okay, this anxiety can be my plus one for the day. It can come with me to see the York walls and come to the museum. it can just come along with me. And it is really that. It's that willingness to let that be that. Because I think so often what I see my clients doing is they feel that emotion. And like what you said before, they kind of attach then that story to it of, oh my God, I'm feeling this anxiety. This shouldn't be here. Why is it here? It's going to ruin the evening. I shouldn't be feeling this way. It's a problem that it's here. I freak out. And then what they're doing is resisting it. They're making the sensation 10 times bigger versus, okay, no, this is just a sensation. It's created by something that my brain said to me. It's not going to ruin the evening. It can just hang out with me. It can just sit here. It doesn't need to be a problem. And yeah, I think doing that, we change our entire relationship to the emotion.
Yeah, beautiful. Well said. Well, before I ask my last couple questions, is there anything else about mind drama, changing your thoughts, creating a new relationship with yourself that is feeling top of mind for you to share?
I don't really think of anything. Just my main thing is that if anyone right now is kind of feeling a bit lost and overwhelmed with their anxiety, you aren't alone. There's so many of us that struggle with this, especially in relationships. And my biggest first tip for you would be to, one, try and work on changing your relationship to that anxiety, like we just said. Maybe research ways to process emotion, find a way that really works for you. And then, yeah, get good at kind of looking at the thoughts, actually creating it. And at first, you might not want to do that. You might want to shy away from it because it's scary and it's painful, and you'd rather just try and numb out and watch Netflix. But I promise you that the more you are willing to really face your fears, they're so much more powerful and in control you're going to feel. So if you're willing to take that step, you're not going to regret it.
Yeah, I love that. All right. So the final question I ask all my guests, because this is the You Love and You Learn podcast, what is one thing you have learned about love that you would want to leave listeners with?
Yeah. And I was thinking about this. I don't know if this counts as being about love. I guess it's just about what I've learned about all relationships is it's never about you. As in, however they're acting, it's never about you. Which sounds very obvious. And I feel like that's probably like a piece of advice that everyone always gives. But my brain really didn't know it. My brain was like, no, it's always about me. If they don't like me, it's because of me. If they cheat on me, it's because of me. If they break up with me, it's because of me. But everyone else is just walking around with their own primitive human brain, having all of its own mind drama, with their own past experiences, history, past traumas, the way their parents brought them up, their little quirks, the way they think about things, their preferences, the way society's influenced the way they think, or maybe their religious backgrounds. Like, everyone has so many things impacting the way their unique brain works. So whatever someone is thinking about you is actually never about you. Yeah, they might be having thoughts about you, but it's not a reflection of you. It's a reflection of their brain. Someone else could have a totally different thought and think the complete opposite. So I think that was one of the best things that I ever learned, was just separating that out. And yeah, knowing that I can still love myself, even if someone else doesn't, if someone else has a different opinion about me, what I think about me is always up to me. So yeah, I'd say that was probably the biggest lesson that I had to learn. So I hope that's useful for everyone else.
Yeah, definitely. I don't know if anyone's shared that directly on the podcast before, so I love that. And what I usually remind myself too is the opposite, which is it's not about them either. My own thoughts about other people are about me. It's like what you said, but I like to remember the opposite direction too, because I think so often we just get stuck in the thoughts of like, well, this person did this to me, and so that must mean this about them. But no, just remember, what are you making it mean about you? So I love both that. Of those. Yeah. Well, amazing. Thank you so much, Rebecca. Where can people stay connected with you if they want to learn more about your work and what you have going on?
Yeah. So the best place to probably find me is on Instagram. So just search Rebecca or Coaching. I also have a podcast called Master Your Relationship Mind Drama. And I have a website, which is RebeccaOrCoaching.com. But yeah, come and find me. And if you enjoyed this podcast, then definitely come and tell me on Instagram.
Yeah, for sure. And I loved joining you for our episode that we did on your podcast. So it's been
fun.
That was
great.
Yeah, fun to do a podcast swap. I'm sure we have plenty of other topics we could get into for future.
Yeah, I love that. I'm so excited.
Yeah, thanks so much. And thank you, everybody. I will see you in the next episode. Thank you so much for listening to the You Love and You Learn podcast. If you've been enjoying the podcast, it would mean the absolute world to me if you could rate and review the podcast, because the more ratings and reviews there are,
the more people that can hear this message. And it's really important to me to get this message out to the world and to create a space where people can learn about love and relationships in a way that is not judgmental, in a way that helps them expand their perspective from the cultural narratives that we've heard and seen in the movies and in Hollywood and the media. And the more ratings and reviews that are there, the more people that can hear this message. So thank you again so much. It really means the world to me that you are listening, and see you in the next episode.